All right, I call this meeting of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely under House Rule 10.01. Before we get started, we will take the roll to see who's here. Anna, please go ahead with the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Mueller. Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excuse. Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Body's present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
Present.
Perfect. All right, a quorum is present. First order of business will be to take care of the minutes from March 9th. Let's see, whose turn is it? Representative Robbins, would you like to move the minutes of March 9th, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair. Sorry, I'm at a State of My Cities event on my other computer, so I'm toggling back and forth, but I'll be back on the committee in a minute.
Yep. No, we're a lot of double Zooming going on this week. Totally understand. Representative Robbins moves the minutes of March 9th, 2021. Any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved for March 9th, 2021. Members, as once again, this is our last very busy day of first deadline week. We have a lot on the agenda. We'll get through as much as we can. And whatever we don't finish, we will come back at 5 o'clock. First up is House File 257, which is a Representative Wasilewicz bill. Representative Wasilewicz, welcome to the committee. I will move your bill, House File 257, be recommended to be referred to the Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Johnson, is this regarding the motion, or do you have a question about the bill?
Chair Becker Finn, it's about the motion. I was going through, like I always do, on the bills that we're hearing in this committee and checking minutes, see what happened in the other committee. I don't know if it was a typo or what, but the official minutes when this bill left the previous committee, Climate, Energy, and Finance, the final motion that was voted on and approved to send this bill out was the, according to the minutes, that Representative Long renewed his motion that House File 164 as amended be re-referred to the Judiciary and Finance and Civil Law Committee. So I'm just wondering if that, and those going back, those minutes were approved with that in there. So I'm just wondering if officially, if we really do have this bill in front of us or not.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. We do have this bill in front of us as far as the committee reports are state. I understand there may be some errors in the minutes, but Chair Long, if you want to weigh in quickly, please go ahead.
Thanks, Chair Becker Finn. Yeah, I'm not aware of any issues with this bill being in front of this committee. I don't know if Representative Wasilewicz wants to respond.
Chair Long, I'll just ask you to have your staff double check if there's a typo in the minutes. But according to my committee administrator, the bill is with us per the official committee reports. But thank you for your diligent reading, Representative Johnson. So as I stated, my motion will be that House Bill 257 be recommended to be re-referred to the Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Wasilewicz has an author's amendment. It is the A5 author's amendment. Any discussion to the A5 amendment? All those in favor of the A5, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's really hard to get my hand up in a fast way. I'm just wondering if she could explain the amendment. I think it's important that authors explain their amendments. So thanks, Madam Chair.
Yep, Representative Wasilewicz, to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and happy to do so, Representative Scott. So the amendment deletes the first section, which was about net metering. We sort of discovered that wasn't necessary, so took that out of the bill. It also provides some clarifying language about what types of dwellings this would apply to, and then adds some language to provide more details and clarification around sort of the application process for the solar panels and the timelines involved in these decisions.
All right, thank you, Representative Wasilewicz. Any further discussion to the A5 amendment? All right, all those in favor of the A5, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted. Representative Wasilewicz, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I first introduced a similar bill after a constituent had reached out to me several months into my first term as a legislator, concerned that their HOA was not allowing them to install solar panels on their roof. This bill would allow people who own a single family dwelling that is in a community with a homeowners or community association to install solar panels on the roof. This would only apply to those owners who are responsible for the maintenance, repair, and insurance of the entire building. There's also a list of sort of guidelines that an HOA could put into place regarding the solar panels that are installed on the roof. So it's not just a do whatever you want approach. There is some things in there that sort of guide the installation. This bill is an expansion of property rights that will allow homeowners to modify their own homes to generate electricity. There's also a piece of the bill, a small piece that makes changes to allow customers of the utility to have access to their electricity usage data. So that's a brief summary of the bill. And I know that we have a couple of people on the list to testify today.
All right, first on the list is Willie Fox. Willie, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Unmute, got it. Good morning. My name is Willie Fox. Can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead, Mr. Fox, and introduce yourself for the record.
Certainly. I'm Willie Fox. I'm a resident city of Hugo. Renewable energy has always been important to me. It's always just made sense. Solar power is clean and unlimited. I drive an all-electric car. My dream is to power my car direct from the sun as it charges in my garage. Behind me is a picture of that dream. I've worked with a local solar installation company to design the plan for 18 solar panels installed on my roof. This plan was rejected by my HOA. And a point of clarification, doesn't the HOA exist to mandate architectural conformity? The answer to that question is no. My HOA actually mandates architectural diversity. The houses next to mine cannot be the same color. They must have a different elevation and design. The three houses across the street from me all have different roof lines and different shingle colors. So I was surprised when the HOA response to my solar panel installation, they were saying, and let's see if I can share it here. I think I'm sharing, I might not be, but anyways. The plan does not conform to the exterior appearance architectural standards set forth by the developer and builders of the association. Now, if I've read the architectural standards document, it does not mention solar panels anywhere. And that's essentially the loophole. So why don't I just go to my board and ask them to vote? The answer is I don't have a board. My neighborhood is 3 years old and still has not been turned over to the residents. The residents don't have declarant control. When will the neighborhood turn over to the residents? It's apparently a complicated question. I have a master developer and four individual developers or builders. As best I can tell, it'll be when all builders are finished building everything. And once that happens, it appears they are free to open up more land and keep building. And there's plenty of farmland all around. So I've made reference to getting a bit of a runaround. I've asked a lot of people a lot of questions, and it's hard to get a straight answer. I was eventually told that the aesthetic may not be visually pleasing to other residents. I was also told that installation is not allowed because it may impact insurance and warranty for the roof. These are finally two valid concerns, and I would be more than happy to meet them and conform. But unfortunately, I was not given that option.
Mr. Fox, do you have additional slides? Otherwise, if you could stop sharing your screen so we could actually see your face while you're testifying, that would be helpful.
Okay, that's a good point. All right. How about now? Better?
Yep, Yep, and please go ahead and keep in mind we have a very busy schedule today.
Certainly, I have a little more to go. Let's skip around. And so essentially this, the question, as I understand it, it's a solar access rights question. It's not a question of solar easement. If you go to the website, solar.maps.umn.edu, it's a website created by the University of Minnesota graduate students, kind of rates your home in terms of easement. My home rates as good. And so effectively, the panels are going to add resilience to the grid. They add resilience to the entire grid. And that website is sponsored in part by XL Energy. XL Energy has a plan that they call Solar Rewards. The Solar Rewards basically gives them access to cheaper energy. And when they have access to cheaper energy, everyone else's cost goes down. So another check in favor of what I'm talking about. Let's see. I'm going to talk just a moment about, you may have heard recently about the state of Texas. They had a rolling blackout. You may be familiar with Tim Boyd, the now former mayor of Colorado City, Texas. His infamous Facebook post begins with, "Let me hurt some feelings while I have a minute." He goes on to say, "If you don't have electricity, you step up and come up with a game plan." He concludes with, "Don't be a part of the problem, be a part of the solution." He sent this message as millions of homes in the state were without power for several days. And boy, if that sentiment hasn't really stuck with me ever since I heard it. So a letter to my representative was my last idea. Why is it even necessary? I've never pursued legislative action in my life, but here I am today. And I'm happy to speak in support of HF 257. The action is reasonable and responsible. The guidance makes sense. Just as renewable energy is reasonable, responsible, and just makes sense. So in closing, I will state that I'm simply asking for access to solar access rights, please. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier I have on the list is Patrick Hines. Please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines with Messerly Kramer. I'm representing the Community Associations Institute, Minnesota chapter. CAI represents the interests and provides guidance to homeowner associations throughout the state of Minnesota. I want to thank first Representative Wasilewicz and the proponents of the bill who we have met with multiple times to discuss our concerns and to make some recommended changes to the bill. I would say as a threshold matter, homeowner associations are controlled by the owners once the association gets turned over. These owners form a board of directors. They are all volunteers. They're not professionals. They're your neighbors. And sometimes it's difficult for volunteer owners who are acting as a board of directors to process such things as solar panels. We understand that they need to be responsive to their residents, but we also understand that they're serving in a volunteer capacity, and sometimes it makes it difficult for them to process all the changes that come through with any manner of public policy. Regarding the bill itself and the A5 amendment, we are happy with the clarification as to the applicability because it makes it clear that this applies to a standalone building where one owner owns it in its entirety and is solely responsible for the maintenance and insurance, so that we're not getting into a situation where we're forcing a association to pick up any of the cost or liability associated with installing panels. Our biggest concern is with the 60-day timeline that is in the bill. That is taken from Minnesota Statute 1599, often referred to as the 60-day rule. That was drafted to apply to state agencies and local units of government who have professional staff who are able to process permits and applications. We do have concerns applying that same standard to a volunteer board. And I do appreciate the amendment because it has made a number of changes in order to try to make the process more clear for homeowner associations and to provide a little more guidance as to what type of complete application would be needed before any timeline like that applies. We still have concerns about applying an automatic approval process, but I know Representative Wasilewicz and the proponents are committed to working with us as we iron out language, and I am committed to do so as well. I'll make one final comment about the language, because it was raised to me after we hit the deadline for submitting an amendment. There's section 5 of the bill, which begins on line 5.15. We believe is unnecessary and may require HOAs to try to amend their declarations to meet the standards of the statute. Amending a declaration can be very, very difficult. We actually had a bill authored by Representative Carlson last year in order to create a court process in order to do this. That's how difficult it could be. I don't think it's necessary for the bill's purpose to have this section, but I do want to have a little more consultation with counsel, because it was brought up late in the process and something I had not seen. So thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you for your testimony. I don't have any other testifiers on the list. Any member discussion to the bill? Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Wasilewicz for bringing this bill forward, and mentioned that we did just hear from one testifier today, but that this concern is really widespread and in our committee on climate and energy. We heard from several other testifiers and had written submissions as well. So this is an issue that is, I think, we're seeing in a lot of homeowners associations for folks who want access to being able to produce their own energy. So I do think that this is an important issue for Minnesotans to have that right for themselves. And I really appreciate Mr. Hines being willing to work on this, and Representative Wasilewicz for bringing the amendment forward, and looking forward to this moving forward.
All right, thank you, Representative Long. Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And my concerns with this bill is, when you move into a homeowners association, you have the opportunity to read over the covenants and the bylaws before you even sign the purchase agreement. Or you sign the purchase agreement, it's a contingent, you have so many days to read over the bylaws. And to me, that's the time to ask those questions. And when you move into a homeowners association, what goes with that is certain restrictions on your freedom to do exactly what you may want to do with your property. I don't live in a homeowners association, so if I wanted to put rooftop solar on, I could. But it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, but if you are in a homeowners association and they prohibit it, or they decide amongst themselves that it's not something that they think it is what the road that they want to go down, I think that's, you know, it's kind of a buyer beware sort of a thing before you purchase the home. Now, the other option to me would be to work with, if the bylaws are sort of silent on this issue, is to work with the association people on the board, as well as other homeowners in the area that may want to do the same thing as you, and rally together, say that this is what we'd like to do, and make a change that way. But those are my concerns with the bill. I do think 60 days is not long enough. You know, you have to wait on contractors to get bids back to you, and these decisions have to be made within 60 days. I think that's probably a little bit too short of a period of time. So those are my comments. I won't be supporting the bill today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Wasilewicz, any response?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the things that we've heard from several homeowners that have testified, as Chair Long said in the Energy Committee, was that they weren't able to have their HOA do anything. So instead of saying, we'll work with you to figure something out, the HOAs just said no. And that's not really, if the goal is to try and accomplish something and have something, whether it's we're going to make a policy that says we'll allow them or not allow them, that hasn't happened. So it's essentially just been, here's a thing that maybe applies to this. Most of these HOAs don't have anything specific that applies to solar panels. And certainly they could do that, but they haven't up until this point. And then when homeowners sort of inquire about that or have questions or want to move forward, they're often just told no, and there's no further discussion, and there's not an effort for folks to come together and have these conversations. So I think that's what we've heard from several homeowners that have tried to do this. And so we're trying to make it easier for those folks to be able to generate their own electricity. Another thing, just wanted to sort of point out, now I lost my train of thought here, but I just wanted to point out that this is sort of a thing that's going to be a bigger issue in the future. And we know that more and more homeowners associations are going to pop up as developments are built. The one that Mr. Fox lives in is actually not that old. It's only a few years old. And as he said, it's sort of continuing to expand. I think it's important to understand that this is a sort of a future looking issue, that we know this is going to be a thing that folks are going to want to do, and they want to be prepared for that going into the future. And Representative Scott, if you could just restate the second thing that you said. I had it in my mind and then it just sort of went away.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Representative Wasluck. I think you covered basically what I said. My other idea was just that several people within the are part of the homeowners association would work together to go, if they want a similar thing, or if they think that even if they don't want solar panels, they think that everybody should have the right to do that, then you go to the homeowners association in numbers and masses. We all know how that works, right? There's strength in masses. So I think there are ways to do this without mandating this upon a private entity.
And Madam Chair, if
Representative Robbins, and then
can I just reply?
Real
I just
quick, remember, Representative
the other piece was the 60, thank you, Madam Chair. The other piece was the 60-day. I just remembered as you were talking, Representative Scott. And I will say the 60-day is when an application is received. So it doesn't necessarily have to do with, the idea is that the application is complete when it's turned over to the HOA so that they have all the information that they need. If they don't have all the information that they need to make a decision, they do have that extra time if they reply to the homeowner within that 15, I can't remember if it's 15 days or 15 business days, in writing saying that they need more information, that they can have that additional time. So that is part of what we tried to do. I will also say that I haven't heard from folks with the homeowners associations about what time would work. And I also don't believe that we can just let these conversations go on for years and years with no outcome or no decision made. So we tried to put something in there that would be flexible, but also acknowledging that there may be an opportunity where the board or someone else may need more information.
All right, Representative Robbins, and then we need to get to the vote. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm sorry about my dog. So in line 316 and 317 of the bill, it says basically, notwithstanding any covenant, restriction, or condition contained in any deed, security instrument, homeowners association document, or other instrument affecting the sale, transfer, interest in the real property, except as provided in this section. So if there already is a covenant or restriction in a homeowner's document, this would supersede that. Can you clarify that for me? Thank you.
And actually, Representative Robbins, I believe it's the opposite, but Representative Wasluck.
Let me just take a look at the language here. And I've had this, we've talked about this before. I'm not sure if Mr. Teaglin can address that. I know we've talked about this before, and I know he had answered that question for me.
Mr. Teaglin, please introduce yourself for the record and answer quickly so that we can get to other business today.
Hi, Chair Becker Finn, Representative Wasluck, Representative Robbins, representatives of the committee. My name is Peter Teaglin. I represent the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. As for this subdivision here, I believe that it spells out the conditions that the private entity may apply to an applicant that would want to install solar panels. And, excuse me, that the covenants would not, the covenants as written would be modified by this to allow for solar panels to be installed within the allowable conditions in section 4 of this bill.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Robbins, my reading as an attorney is that the bill is doing is saying that going forward they may not prohibit, and then if you can't go back in time and change a contract that's already been agreed to by both parties. So I think it's saying if it's already there, we can't change that agreement between the parties. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree with you that that's how it usually works, but that does not seem to be what this language says. So if someone could get back to me on that, I don't want to hold up the committee's time anymore, but I do think the reading of it is that notwithstanding means that they could supersede existing contracts. So I would like clarity on that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Robbins. Representative Wasowick, if you can make sure that issue gets resolved when you're back in the Climate Committee and maybe work on an amendment if needed. With that, Representative Wasowick, quick closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for the good discussion. And as I stated earlier, this is really about allowing property owners to be able to generate their own electricity with the solar panels. And so I would appreciate support for this moving back to energy. Thank you.
All right, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 257 as amended be re-referred to the Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Rebecca Finn. Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist. Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
I have 10 ayes and 6 nays.
That the motion prevails and House File 257 as amended is on its way to Energy and Climate Finance and Policy. With that, I will turn over the gavel to Vice Chair Mueller. The next bill on the agenda is my bill. So Vice Chair Mueller, take the wheel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the next bill up is House File 1404. excuse me, Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to move your bill?
Moved, Madam Chair, and then would also move that now that the bill is before us, I will move the DE1 amendment. And I'm assuming that folks will want to walk through. It's a pretty lengthy amendment, but that would be my motion to then also move the DE1.
Okay, great. And just to clarify that we're moving the bill to be recommended to be placed on the general register. Chair Becker-Finn has moved the bill, has also moved the DE1 amendment. And I believe that Mr. Hopkins can walk us through what this DE amendment does. Go ahead, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so I'm just going to walk through the DE1 section by section. Section 1, this reestablishes the Legislative Commission on Data Practices and Personal Data Privacy, which expired in 2019. Section 2 allows private educational data on students to be disclosed to travel.
Oh, it looks like you froze, Mr. Hopkins. I don't know if that's just for me or for others, too.
Section 3. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 3 of the bill creates a cross-reference in the Government Data Practices Act for a new statute on DNR minor data, which is contained in Section 7 of the bill. Section 4 just corrects a typo in the automated license plate reader statute in Chapter 13. Section 5 in the police body camera statute in Chapter 13. This adds a requirement that biannual audit reports be sent to relevant legislative committees in addition to the Legislative Commission on Data Practices. Section 6 on page 6, this is in the statute concerning data maintained by the Ombudsperson for Corrections. It clarifies that the enumerated types of public data only apply when it's a closed case of the Ombudsperson. Section 7, this is at the bottom of page 6. This is the DNR section for DNR data on minors. It classifies as private the enumerated kinds of data that DNR collects on minors. It also clarifies that data about minors that are collected continue to be private even after the individual is no longer a minor after they turn 18. Section 8, this makes changes to the vital record statute in regards who can obtain an individual's certified birth or death record. Section 9, this is the U visa bill. It deals with, it requires law enforcement agencies to process a specific immigration-related request for victims of certain crimes who are foreign nationals. Finally, Section 10, this is again related to the Legislative Commission on Data Practices. It's at the bottom because it's an uncoded section and it deals with how the appointing authorities are going to make initial appointments to the commission and when the commission will have its first meeting. So, Madam Chair and members, that concludes the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. And what I'd like to do now is vote on the DE1 and then we can have testifiers and member discussions because the DE1 puts the bill in the shape the author desires. Are there any questions about that? All right, seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the DE1 is adopted. And Chair Becker-Finn, the bill is now in the shape you desire. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as was mentioned last week, this is our mini omnibus bill on some policy data provisions. It includes bills. I know Mr. Hopkins referenced what the bills were, but not who had authored them. So there are provisions here from Representative Scott's bill, Representative Feist, as well as a couple of bills that I carried. Representative Cleavorn's bill about the death records, and then one small piece from Representative Tujan's bill on the Ombudsperson for Corrections. And so with that, I will turn it over to testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know you've called this before, this data omnibus, the data bus bill. So so let's go ahead. I think Matt Ealing is here to testify. Go ahead, Matt, please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. As the schedule is pretty full today, my comments are going to be brief, and I'll stand by for any other questions on data elements coming out of the DE. But the main point I wanted to make is that Minkoji supports the inclusion of Representative Scott's bill to reestablish the Data Practices Commission as part of the DE amendment. You can see that in lines 1.4 through 2.17, and also at the end if you're looking for reference. Our organization's support for the commission has been longstanding for a variety of reasons, including the fact that it serves really an important educational resource for legislators that are seeking to learn more about data policy issues. And it also provides a venue where complex data issues can receive in-depth informational hearings far before bills are even contemplated. As folks are aware, the regular committee process often lacks the necessary time to delve into issues that have multiple competing facets and complexities, such as many data policy issues do. And I think back to debates over automated license plate readers and police body cameras, for examples. And these are issues that involved multiple aspects of privacy, access, oversight, contractor issues, Fourth Amendment issues, and so forth. And informational hearings on those issues began in the Data Practices Commission long before they moved on to bill form into other legislative committees. And more recently, a temporary successor committee to the Data Practices Commission reviewed the pretty complex matter of regulating facial recognition technology over a number of informational hearings. And this year, you can see language in facial recognition bills that have been introduced that was pulled directly from the discussions held during those hearings. So you can see the really direct connection between the research purpose of the commission and the generation of policy. So we feel that this commission provides a very valuable institutional resource to the legislature, and we would urge that it be reauthorized and reconstituted. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Next up, we have Mark Hasse. Go ahead, Mr. Hasse, please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Sorry for the delay. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Mark Hasse, and I am the Ombuds for Corrections. The Office of the Ombuds for Corrections investigates complaints regarding the actions and policies of Minnesota corrections agencies. We can take complaints from staff, the general public, and incarcerated people. And I should, before I go on, I'll just mention again that the portion of the bill that I'm speaking to is Section 6. In current law, the identity of individuals making complaints to our office is public data. This is contrary to national standards for ombudsperson confidentiality set forth by the U.S. Ombudsman Association. And it raises concerns about the willingness of individuals, particularly those who are in very vulnerable situations, to file complaints. Earlier this session, in Rep. Jiang's House File 916, we sought to make this complainant identity data completely private. But after discussions about concerns with government transparency advocates and others, and because the office was just newly reinstated, we'd like to take some more time to better understand the implications of that broader change, although we still have some concerns. What is before you now, Madam Chair and members, is a narrower change that would make complainant identity data private only until a case is closed, after which time it would still be public. Keeping this data private during the course of an investigation is critical to protect the identity of the investigation, to keep it from being compromised in this unique situation where complainants are subject to the complete care and control of the subjects of their complaint. In closing, I want to thank Representative Jiang for carrying the initial bill on this and Chair Becker Finn for carrying it here in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hasi. Next up, we have Adosh Uni. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Uni. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Adosh Uni. I am the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. And thank you to Chair Becker Finn for including this really important language on data sharing with tribal nations around American Indian students and tribal affiliated students and descendant students. This language is very important as tribal nations and school districts have a responsibility to engage in consultation under the federal Every Student Succeeds Act. We have 37 districts and charters that currently have to engage in this consultation. And part of that consultation for tribes to be able to serve their students to the best of their ability to support their academic achievement is for access to local education data about those students to see how they're doing academically, to see their engagement, and any other data points that may be helpful for them to support input on programming and to provide ancillary services related to their education. Many districts do share this data willingly. They consider the tribal nations already part of that list that you see in the bill of allowable entities and uses for sharing private educational data without receiving prior parental consent. Many districts do believe that tribal nations do fall into that, but some do believe that because they're not explicitly spelled out in the statute that they don't have the legal ability to share the private educational data for the legitimate educational purpose of supporting those students. So this proposal would put tribal nations in there explicitly, providing the direction and the legal ability for districts to be able to share this data with the tribal nations to support the educational achievement of American Indian students and tribal identifying students and descendant students. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. Next up is Rich Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I am speaking directly to the first time there's a public hearing on the Privacy Commission. I support the Privacy Commission. It's been around since 2014. It has served as a useful tool. As you know, legislation passed by the legislature on these kinds of issues and other kinds of legislation, but particularly in these kinds of legislations, can be robust, sensible, and imaginative and help the people, or it can be perceived by the public when the piece of legislation is passed as being anemic and ill-conceived. What the commission is able to do, as Mr. Elling so well said, is a lot of discussion can take place so that something that is passed on these kinds of issues, it won't reflect badly on the legislature as a whole, a bill passed, that it was sensible, it was due diligent, it looked at the issues. There is a challenge now for the commission, and granted, we'll see what the topics are, but there are topics other than just dealing with privacy. As you know, if you look at the charge of the commission, it also deals with data practices. Data practices, as you know, deals with access to public information and also on privacy. So it's important that I think, and I know that other policymakers do, is start to take a look at the issues of access to public information, which is constantly an issue with many of your constituents, and who I work with many of your constituents who call me and call organizations like represented by Matt Elling. Hey, how do I get public data? Another item that's been a discussion of issues is data collection of private and confidential data on Minnesotans, and why isn't the Tennyson warning being given, and all those kinds of things. So, Madam Chair, I'm very much obliged to you that Chair Becker Finn has taken it under her wing, and I want to thank Representative Scott for getting it going again. And just as a courtesy to let you know, in the other body, it was heard the other day, and it's going on its way over there too. So much obliged to y'all. And as one says, let's go to it and do it and have some fun on some of these issues over the next couple of years.
Thanks, Mr. Neumeister, and thanks for your enthusiasm this morning. I'll just say, too, as somebody who participated in the commission, I found that it was a really valuable experience. I think I've spoken to that before, and I'm glad to see that it's in the data bus. So I don't know if we have any member questions. I'm not seeing any hands, and I don't believe that we have any other testifiers. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Madam Chair Becker Finn. Thanks for putting this bill together, and particularly on the Data Commission. I thank you for the co-authors that are in this committee on both sides of the aisle on that. But just wanted to thank you for putting a data bill together and recognizing the importance of this issue. And I plan to support the bill today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I don't see any other hands raised. Thank you, Representative Scott. Chair Becker Finn, final comments on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, as well as all the testifiers and Representative Scott. I think this data bus is a great example of bipartisan good policy work that we can get done together and hopefully move forward despite whatever else goes on this session. Really happy to work with all the authors that were part of the different pieces of this bill, and just request member support for the data bus.
Thank you. Chair Becker Finn renews her motion that House File 1404, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hurd.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
And Representative Zhang.
Aye.
There are 16 ayes and no nays.
There being 16 ayes, the motion prevails. House File 1404, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. And Madam Chair, I'm handing the gavel back over to you and working my way to the testifiers table.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the handoff. So now the next bill on the agenda today is House File 707, which is a Vice Chair Moeller bill. Vice Chair Moeller, would you like to move your bill?
So moved, Madam Chair. And I believe we're moving the bill to be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee.
That is correct, Vice Chair Moeller. Vice Chair Moeller moves that House File 707 be recommended to be referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance Policy Committee. Representative Moeller, I understand you have an A3 amendment. Do you want to tell us briefly what the A3 does?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. So overall, the bill is moving around a lot of pieces of our current criminal sexual conduct statutes, and the A3 amendment is really cleaning up where there were some citation issues, some things that we didn't catch in the initial bill drafting and the first engrossment. And some of those things, even though they were just, a missed paragraph reference results in can change the amount of bed space and affects the fiscal note. So although these are technical changes, they're really important to the overall bill and just making sure that all these statutes work together in the way that we intended.
And just to clarify, Vice Chair Mueller, we have the A4 amendment to the amendment that modifies the underlying A3. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Madam Chair. And again, that is just one of those another catch of some citations. And so I would move the A4 amendment as well.
Okay. So just to make sure that we are all clear, we have moved the A3 amendment and then moved the A4 amendment to the amendment. All those in favor of the A4 amendment to the amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted. And now to the A3 as amended, which puts the bill in the shape that the author desires. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the A3 amendment as amended is adopted. The bill is now in the shape that you would like. Vice Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's an honor to be before you to present this bipartisan bill, House File 707, which is a rewrite of the criminal sexual conduct statutes. This bill is a product of dozens of survivors, practitioners, and others who came together in a legislatively created working group over the past 2 years to determine how our criminal sexual conduct statutes can better achieve justice for survivors. The working group issued its recommendations to us in January. They are included in the materials. Thanks to Suzanne Elwell from the Office of Justice Program for leading this group and for all of those who participated in that process. Sexual assault crimes are highly underreported, and when they are reported, there's a very real possibility that they will not be fully investigated or changed or result in convictions. And at the legislature, we've passed a number of important laws to lead to systems change. And this bill, members, is really the next stage in our efforts to provide justice. And I'm happy to have worked closely on this bill with Representative O'Neill and numerous stakeholders. House File 707, which incorporates the recommendations of the working group, was described in more detail in the Public Safety Committee. In fact, we had a full hearing just on this bill, and we're going back there again so we can have more discussion because we ran out of time. And because of the robust testimony we had in that committee, I'm just going to highlight a couple of pieces of the bill for you now. The bill reorganizes the statutes, as I mentioned before. One of the big reorganizations separates out adult crimes from child crimes. It clarifies, adds to, and moves to some of the definitions. It adds cases where the victim was voluntarily intoxicated. It protects more minors by raising the age to 13 and creating consistent differentials between the age of the actor and the complainant. It creates a new crime of sexual extortion, and many of the letters in your packet talk about the need for that. And it creates a working group to examine predatory offender registration. The working group, as it reflects in their report, really talked about the need to reform predatory offender registration, especially in juvenile cases. And the group came up with some ideas, but not everyone that needed to be part of that discussion was part of the working group, and it wasn't part of their initial charge from us anyway. So I really ask that we can continue that discussion with the creation of this working group. Because we are short on time, we have two testifiers here, but I have many more available for any questions that you might have about the bill. And with that, Madam Chair, I believe my first testifier today is Katie Kelly.
Yep. Ms. Kelly, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. I'm Katie Kelly, and I currently live with family in District 32A. I hold a Master of Fine Arts degree in musical theater, and I'm a survivor of drug-facilitated rape. My rape occurred on June 28th, 2019, committed by a man I had known for 4 years and considered a friend. I completed a SANE exam and reported my rape to the Minneapolis Police Department, but the man that raped me wasn't charged. When I met with the prosecutor on my case to discuss why charges against my rapist were dropped, he informed me that it was a result of how the current rape laws are written. The state could not prove the use of force in the non-consensual act, as date rape drugs can be eliminated from the body within a couple of hours, making it extremely difficult for blood or urine samples to accurately detect the substances. Second, they could not prove that I was involuntarily intoxicated because I was voluntarily enjoying some cocktails that evening before I lost consciousness. Finally, because I lost consciousness, they could not prove I was non-communicable during the act. The rape has impacted my life in profound ways. I was diagnosed with PTSD and depression, resulting in the need for long-term mental health therapy and anti-anxiety medications. These mental health challenges have harmed my relationships with my family, which will need repairing over time. Most of all, at age 44, I don't know who I am right now. Being raped by a married man that I considered a friend has caused me to question many of my values and beliefs about men, religion, patriarchy, equity, how we generally treat each other as humans. I will never again be the woman or person I was prior to that rape, and it's going to take a long time for me to figure out who I am now. Being raped fundamentally changes you and your perspective of the world around you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing your testimony with us today, Ms. Kelly. Next on the list is Ms. Granda. If you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, members. Good morning, Chair of the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. My name is Keila Marie Granda. I come to you this afternoon or this morning, excuse me, with requests. I have been part of this since before it even started. I have helped Representative Mueller. I worked with Senator Limmer. I have had the honor and the privilege of working with a lot of individuals, getting bipartisan support for this bill, reaching consensus even amongst public defenders and prosecutors for the need for change. And I just want to do a quick call back to what we were originally created for, and I want to raise up the voices of victim survivors quickly. At the beginning, our desired outcomes were to create a new attitude in the Minnesota criminal justice system towards survivors of sexual violence, be part of systemic and sweeping changes, lifting up the historically silenced voices of people of color, Indigenous and Native people, people who identify as LGBTQIA+, people who are disabled, and other Minnesotans who have not had equal access to the criminal justice system, and that includes those that we in the criminal justice system might identify as offenders. To get better involved as survivors and learn how we can affect change in the legal system so we can raise up our voices. We also asked at the beginning of this that we look into restorative justice practices. I feel like we have done so much in the past 18 months throughout this working group, but there's still so much more. Today, I'm asking that we support what's going forward, but that we also know that, as someone told me in the working group, this is just putting a Band-Aid on a hatchet wound, okay? We are creating change. We're doing what we need to do for victim survivors, but we need to do more because we need to understand the overlap between offenders and victim survivors. We need to understand that the change doesn't stop here, and we have the honor and the privilege of making the choice to continue. I come to you today with these asks, and I come to you today bringing some honesty behind me as well, complete honesty. I am a survivor, and with my voice, sharing my voice, I'm a survivor. I'm an educated woman. Actually, I identify as a genderqueer individual with disabilities. I was raped as a result of my gender or my sexuality. My case was a travesty of justice, and it has been displayed multiple times, even through the Deny Justice series. My results were lost, my talk screens were lost, and I was forced to report by the police department. I was forced to report by the very police department that I went to. They actually forced me to report the case, and then I was later told that I was going to be held as a hostile witness if I did not go through with that. My housing was even, my housing that I was at current at the time was even, I was even told I would lose my housing if I did not go through with those charges. My life was wrecked because of what the justice system, the inadequacies of the justice system to try to help survivors like myself. And we need to do more. And that is what I'm asking today, is that we make not the last 7 years in vain, the 7 years of my life. I also just quickly want to tell you, I'm having to hide out in a different state right now because there is a man who is coming after me. I have a lifetime restraining order against him. He has followed me since my case for 7 years. And he has found me, and I have had to take my daughter and I and leave state. And I am scared, but I am still here. I don't want this to lead to me having to hide or something even greater, but I will be here until the end, until this change is made. That's all I got.
Thank you. And really, really appreciate you sharing with us. And I will just say, you know, showing emotion is not a weakness. I think it shows the fire and how you are turning this trauma into real change. And so I thank you for sharing your testimony with us today and for doing this work with Representative Moeller and others. Members, I don't have any other testifiers on the list. I know we have a couple, several people here to answer questions if members have them. But with that, we will move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Moeller. And I don't know if Representative O'Neill is listening in or on this call, but I want to thank her for her work on the commission. I know it was a couple of years of really hard work, and I think, Representative Moeller, you were the one that had the bill a couple of years ago to create this study group. And I think there could be a lot of study groups commissioned to look at statute, overhauling areas of statute that are kind of just difficult to navigate. And this was one of them, as I understand it. So I appreciate your work on that. And I have a question, and I got a question emailed to me yesterday from constituent regarding child pornography laws and whether or not the constituent's concern was that, as she understood it, there were loopholes in that law that didn't really hold accountable the perpetrators of either the ones that were producing it or the ones consuming it. And so I don't know if this bill addresses any of that. My understanding and texting back and forth with Representative O'Neill is that the producers are charged with rape for producing it. But if Representative Moeller knows the answer to that question or anybody on the call, I'm curious about that.
Vice Chair Moeller.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. So this bill doesn't directly change anything with respect to our child pornography laws. I mean, there certainly can be situations where child pornographers are committing acts of sexual assault and could be charged under some of these provisions. But this bill doesn't change the actual child pornography statutes at all. I do know that there are some other bills that are that have been introduced this year related to those statutes. And when I was a member of the Public Safety Committee last time, we had a bill that passed asking the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to really look at how those cases are sentenced. And they came out with their report very recently on the sentencing, and there's recommendations that were made in there too. And there are some bills that have been introduced as a result of those changes. If I don't know if you want anything more specific than that, we certainly could have one of the prosecutors on the call answer more specific questions about child pornography if you'd like.
You know, I think Vice Chair Moeller, I think you answered the question as far as its relation, the relation of that issue to this particular bill. I am sure that you and others will remain committed to working on all these sort of related issues. But, you know, just sticking to the bill in front of us today, I think you've done a good job of answering the question. Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Mueller, for that answer. And yeah, I hope that that's something that can be worked on going forward. If there are indeed loopholes there, we certainly want to close those. And I just wanted to thank the testifiers for coming forward today as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Members, any additional discussion to this bill? All right, Vice Chair Mueller, closing words.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say thank you again to all the participants in the working group. All the people who were on standby to answer questions today worked so hard on many aspects of this bill, but especially a shout out goes to the survivors who participated, the survivors who continue to come forward and share their stories with us today, survivors who aren't willing to go public or who just aren't in a space to go public with that, but who desperately need changes for justice. As Ms. Granda said, this is just one more piece in the puzzle. It's not the end result, and we need to really keep working to make sure that we're achieving justice for survivors and for offenders too, and make the state safer for everybody. So thank you, Madam Chair. I'd appreciate your yes vote.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. And I will note that I don't think it's a coincidence that we're finally getting some of these changes made under the leadership of women like yourself and Representative O'Neill and others committed to this. And again, before we move to the vote, I do want to thank the testifiers and the survivors and everyone who has shared their stories. I know how traumatic it can be to share those stories and experiences even in private. So to share those stories in public is even more brave, but I think very impactful as we move forward on a bill like this. Vice Chair Mueller renews her motion that House File 707 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairmaker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hurt.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny. Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Fang.
Aye.
And Representative Zhang.
Aye.
There's 16 ayes and no nays.
The motion prevails and House File 707 as amended is on its way to the Public Safety Committee. Vice Chair Mueller, we're gonna pass the gavel back and forth again. To move on to House File 1007. So Vice Chair Mueller, we're now doing the back and forth again.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So sorry, I wasn't expecting that. So it caught me a little off guard. Can you remind me what bill this is?
Yep. So I will move. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move House File 1007 regarding court fees paid by tribal representatives. We weren't sure if we were going to get through everything today, but we're going to get this one done while we've got time today. So House File 1007. So I am a member of a subcommittee within the Children's Justice Initiative ICWA subcommittee. And so that is a collaboration between the courts and Department of Human Services to work on issues related to our ICWA statutes and how we can make those statutes work better. One thing that came up through those committee meetings was the need to modify current law as to fees that are paid by tribal nations in their involvement in these cases. And this bill essentially provides conformity throughout the state. And with that, I do have one testifier here today, Lenny Findey, and then happy to answer member questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let's go ahead to your testifier, Mr. Findey. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you and good morning.
My name is Lenny Finday, and I serve as general counsel for the White Earth Nation, and I also serve as co-chair of the ICWA subcommittee for the Children's Justice Initiative. Chair Becker-Finn did a really good job of introducing the bill and the issue. Basically, what happens is when there's an Indian child that is in a proceeding in state court, oftentimes tribes intervene pursuant to the federal Indian Child Welfare Act. The state of Minnesota statutes right now regarding filing fees would require a tribe to file a fee in order to intervene in an action that's been filed solely at the decision of a state county attorney or a state social service agency. The implementation of that, though, is very inconsistent, where there are some judicial districts that are requiring the filing fee and some that are not. And I think that this sort of goes back to issues with the e-filing system and its implementation here in Minnesota. And so I know one of the examples that was discussed with the ICWA subcommittee was a Leech Lake tribal attorney in the Twin Cities. When he was going into different judicial districts to file, it was inconsistent and it caused delays in the tribe's ability to intervene in the case. Interestingly enough, within the state statutes regarding filing fees, other governmental agencies, including the federal government, are exempt from filing fees. However, tribal government sovereign nations are not exempt. And so this bill would just correct that oversight and make it clear and consistent across the board, allow tribes to intervene when necessary, and not delay that intervention or delay the proceedings. That's it in a nutshell. It's our understanding as well that the financial review of the bill would have a very small impact because the filing fees are negligible in terms of that tribes pay. Are negligible in terms of the overall budget for the courts. This has the backing of the Children's Justice Initiative, and we're hoping that the committee will approve it today so it can move on to the to full approval. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Finday. And I don't believe there are any other testifiers. And just to clarify that the motion is that this bill be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Do we have any questions from members? All right, I don't see any. Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And did want to clarify that motion. So it'd be my motion that House File 1007 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill. That being said, the fiscal note did come back as zero, at least to the state. And so did want to reiterate that this is supported by the judicial branch under the leadership of Justice Ann McKeag on the ICWA subcommittee, and just appreciate members' support for the bill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 1007 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill. I think at this time, Madam Chair, we are just rolling. I'm going to turn the gavel back to you.
All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Moeller. We are going to move on to the Representative Ryer bill. Just got to get to the right page on my agenda. House File 2010. This is a Representative Ryer bill, and I will move that House File 2010 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Ryer, your bill is before the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to introduce House File 2010 today. This bill clarifies the reasonable accommodations process in the workplace for Minnesotans with disabilities, specifically related to using an interactive process. By this, I mean that in order to determine what accommodations are required in the workplace, the individual and employer generally engage in conversations or an interactive process about the individual's needs and the practicalities of such a request. Both the Federal American with Disabilities Act and the Minnesota Human Rights Act provide protections from discrimination based on disability, including reasonable accommodations protections. It's important to note, though, that the disability protections in the Minnesota Human Rights Act predate the ADA and use somewhat different language, but to similar effect. And for decades, the courts had interpreted federal and state laws being aligned with respect to an interactive process and reasonable accommodations. Yet in 2019, the Minnesota Supreme Court upheld a lower court's ruling, which interpreted that the Minnesota Human Rights Act was not specifically requiring an interactive process. This was based on an assumption that the Minnesota law was modeled on the ADA, while in fact that Minnesota law was already in place. House File 2010 simply brings the Minnesota Human Rights Act into alignment with the ADA by specifying that an employer and an employee should engage in an interactive process when discussing workplace reasonable accommodations. This is needed because the discrepancy causes confusion. Employers are bound by federal law, but may be more familiar with Minnesota law. This puts them at risk of violating the law, and at the very least, it causes frustration and wasted time and effort. I've spent my career in the business world, and I can tell you, this is the last thing employers want to be worrying about. Instead, we can provide a clear process for both employers and Minnesotans with disabilities who may need a reasonable accommodation in the workplace. With that, I have one testifier from the Minnesota Council on Disabilities here to testify in support of the bill. And additionally, staff from the Minnesota Department of Human Rights are here to answer technical questions if needed. Thank you, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. I have Trevor Turner. If you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Trevor Turner. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. We are a state agency, an independent state agency that advises the Minnesota legislature and the governor on disability-related policy, as well as we serve as advocates for the disability community in Minnesota. First, I want to thank Representative Ryer for carrying this bill and Chair Becker Finn and this committee for giving this bill a hearing. I'm glad that we're moving fast. It makes me really happy to hear that. So House File 2010 is one of our legislative priorities this year because it's important to align state and federal law so that we have a clear and consistent process for Minnesotans with disabilities who may need reasonable accommodations in the workplace. You know, as Representative Ryer mentioned, the origins of House File 2010 stem from the state court appeal ruling in the case of Thalia McBee versus Team Industries Incorporated. This ruling overturned decades of case law and practice, which had interpreted that the state and federal law were aligned with respect to reasonable accommodations and the need for the interactive process. The case was appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2019, where they sided with the Court of Appeals. The court came to their ruling in part because the Minnesota Human Rights Act does not explicitly include the interactive process language in the statute. This ruling was problematic because it relied on an incorrect assumption that the ADA predated the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And as such, the court believed that the Minnesota Human Rights Act omission of the interactive process language was intentional. However, the Minnesota Human Rights Act was passed in Minnesota long before the federal ADA was written. And when the Minnesota Human Rights Act added the disability protections, interactive process was simply not a commonly used phrase in the public accommodation discussions in that era, which is why it's not included in the state statute at the time. And this is by no means intentionally left out. So this bill seeks to clarify the Human Rights Act explicitly to include the interactive process language. And I think it's important to note that this bill does not add any new obligations for employers, but rather it aligns federal and state law and helps ensure that we have a clear and consistent process for Minnesotans with disabilities who are seeking reasonable accommodations in the workplace. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and thank you to the committee. I yield my time.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, any discussion to the bill? All right. I will note that this bill is being carried by Senator Abler in the Senate. And I know as someone who cares deeply about the ADA and our ability to enforce the ADA and actually get results for people with disabilities. I think this is really important. And I also appreciate the updating of the language to get rid of the terminology of a disabled person. I think it's important that we update those statutes to be more person-centered in the way that we talk about our community members who live with disabilities. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to speak in support of this bill. I've actually had several of my constituents reach out to me specifically on this bill in support of it and giving me their personal stories of having worked in this area and having felt like they, for a variety of reasons, some really simple, right, like some simple accommodations that could be met and felt like they needed to leave their job because they weren't able to have those met. So I really appreciate and thank Representative Ryer for bringing this legislation forward. I think it's important. And I think it's a great step in the right direction.
All right. Representative Ryer, any closing words on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, just to say thank you for your support, and I appreciate the intention to move this forward.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer, and a shout out to Honey Bear in the background and how well-behaved she's being during our committee time. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2010 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott. Representative Scott.
Representative Scott lost her internet connection. She's trying to call in.
Gotcha. Okay, I'll come.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, Representative Johnson. Thank you.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
And Representative Scott.
Ooh, just in time. Aye.
There's 16 ayes and no nays.
All right. Quick move there, Representative Scott. Glad we got you reconnected. With that, the motion prevails and House File 2010 is recommended to be placed on the General Register. With that, members, we have two more bills on the agenda, but one of them will not officially be in our possession until this evening after session. And so with that, we'll come back at 5 p.m. today to finish up the remaining two bills on the agenda. As I know, there are testifiers for Representative Pinto's bill, and I want to make sure we're not too disjointed in our discussion of that bill. So with that, the Judiciary Finance Committee stands in recess. Call the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee back to order. Thank you, members, for jumping on, obviously much later than we intended, but hopefully we can get through these last two bills and we can all get on with our evenings. First up, we have Representative Pinto's bill, House File 1942. I will move that House File 1942 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative Pinto, your bill is now before us. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be with you and the committee. I served on this committee a couple terms ago and really glad to be back with you all. So the bill before you members makes a change relating to birth records, and it connects with a program called the College Savings Accounts that have been operated by the City of St. Paul. This is a program that allows supports families when they have a new baby, put some money into an account, and research has shown that it can make a really big difference, and a surprisingly big difference in outcomes for that child. We heard this proposal in the House Early Childhood Committee, which I chair, and it received support there. And there is an issue, though, with making sure that the families can have the enrollment that will allow them to be supported in this. I'm going to turn things to the testifier to kind of explain, if I can, what exactly is needed, and then we'll go from there. But I think that Manir Karkar Ramos from City of St. Paul is here, and so if we can call on him, Madam Chair.
All right. If you could introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Munir Karcher-Ramos, and I'm the Director of the Office of Financial Empowerment with the City of St. Paul. I'm here today before you to testify in support of House File 1942. There should be a handout posted as well, and I'll be making reference to that throughout my testimony here briefly. So I have running kids around upstairs, so excuse me if you hear stomping. Just over a year ago, on January 1st, 2020, the City of St. Paul launched College Bound St. Paul, a citywide children's savings account program starting at birth. On the handout provided, you'll see the tremendous body of research that has been conducted on small dollar savings accounts. For example, research showed that low to moderate income children who have between $1 to $499 in a college savings account are three times more likely to go to college and four times more likely to graduate. Other research have showed reductions in maternal depression, increases in child social-emotional development, and higher parental aspirations for their children's future. This research is undeniable, and the reason why the City of St. Paul cannot pass up the opportunity to launch a children's savings account program in our city. The children's savings account programs across the country use public birth record information to auto-enroll children into programs. In our first year, the city enrolled just over 3,000 children who were born in 2020, but we could have enrolled close to 4,700 children if we didn't run into issues with public birth record information. The state of Minnesota passed a policy back at the turn of, in the early 1900s that made birth records confidential for children born to mothers who are not married. In other words, what the impact is today is the city could not open a children's savings account for about 1,600 children in our first year because of this confidential birth record provision. This bill is asking the state legislature to create an exemption for children's savings accounts to have access to certain birth record information. In an existing statute, a birth records exemption does exist for family and children collaboratives providing services to young children. The city is asking for a comparable exemption for our children's savings account program as well. Having this information will allow us to fully enroll children in the CSA program. If you look at the chart on our handout, this policy would increase access to the children's savings account program by about 16,000 participants over the next 10 years, or about 1,600 babies per year. In other words, passing this bill will ensure an additional 16,000 children could have investment in a small dollar account that significantly increases their likelihood to attend and graduate college and have many other effects. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and answer any questions.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just before we go to questions, I just wanted to make sure that members are aware that information, the default for these records is that they be public information. It's not in the language of the bill. It's in the statute, the Subdivision 1, just before Subdivision 2 that's modified in the bill. So the default is that this is public information. There simply is this exception right now that if the mother is not married, but then that is made confidential. And what this is, as Mr. Karcher-Ramos said, is then providing this particular exemption, an exception that can then provide the support for the family. So I just want to make sure that we're clear on that. And with that, ready for questions, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair and Representative Pinto, I understand what you're trying to do here, but Why don't you just get the mother's consent to turn over this information?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Scott, thank you for the question. And it's unfortunate because of the timing this has all worked, because we had a parent, a mother who's participating, who wants to participate in the program, who testified in the Early Childhood Committee, is not able to join us, but I have her testimony in front of me, and perhaps we could even send it. She is a mother who has a couple kids, and she has a baby that she wanted to have enrolled, and was excited to learn about this opportunity, but had to you know, complete the paperwork and all, and found, I've even got, she said, I have the College Bound flyer taped onto my wall in my bedroom. Every time I see it, I tell myself I'm going to do it, but there's always at least three other things I had to do first, such as change the diaper, wash the bottle, and that we've got a newborn involved, right? Something that always come up. And I didn't get around to enroll my baby to College Bound. And so it's this challenge. I'll maybe turn to Mr. Karcharamos regarding anything more on this, but I would found it really compelling, the experience of this mom and other moms. Just you think about what happens when you have a new baby. You've just got so much going on. And so that's the challenge of being able to have those records in that way regarding this particular exception that we have under Minnesota law.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And well, I think maybe you might need to go back to the drawing board here and find a way that when the moms are at the hospital to check a box on a form or something, because there's a reason that these are confidential records. And anytime we go playing with these birth records outside of current statute, it's really a sticky wicket. There are women that want and trust that confidentiality. And for them not to be able to give consent for this information to be shared, I just don't think it's I don't want to say betraying their trust, but it could be in some cases betraying their trust. And so I have problems with this bill because of that, and I'm not going to be able to support it unless there's some way for those moms to give consent for that information to be shared. Thank you.
Mr. Karcharamos, did you want to respond to that?
Madam Chair and members, what we know about children's savings accounts is that auto enrollment and, you know, having it early on does ensure, you know, sort of optimal participation, you know, in the program. Families still do have the chance to, you know, opt out both on the birth record side and on the program side of things. So what we see here is sort of the overall sort of benefit, you know, for, you know, families in the city of St. Paul and really having access, you know, to the program.
Thank you. And I've been notified that we had one other testifier that wasn't here initially, but he is here now. And I want to make sure we get that public testimony first, and then we'll go to further committee discussion. Mr. Neumeister, if you could unmute yourself, identify yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Rich Neumeister, and today I'm putting on my privacy advocate hat. I oppose the bill in its whole. It goes against the philosophy here in Minnesota that we respect people's privacy, particularly when it's held by the government, particularly a birth record, which is the most private of many sets of data for individuals. If you take a look at the current language, and I don't have it in front of me, I don't have the bill in front of me, but you'll see that the exceptions is very specific with very high priorities. Child support, I believe for MinCare. There's like four or five different examples. To do this for one entity so that you can say, oh, we got $50 waiting for you in the bank account. Hey, why don't you participate in the program, is not, I think, an appropriate way, and it's definitely a bad precedent. And I remind you how in Minnesota, we have had some strong, fair information principles. And one of them, which we highly prize of, is there must be a way for individuals to prevent information about them that was obtained for one purpose from being used or made available for other purposes without their consent. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for me, who's been active on these issues in our state for many years, this is a proposal that does not merit that exception for the consent. And it can be done, but it's up to them whether to do it rather than just, you know, they can deal with some of the public data aspects of that may be on a birth certificate. But to get it also private and confidential, I do have some concerns, at least with how I saw the reading of the amendment. So I just say no to the bill. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you. I thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this. So, first of all, totally understand forgetting to do things when you have a newborn. My son is 2, and I'm just now getting around to getting his birth certificate. So that just shows you like how difficult it is, right, when you have a newborn baby. So I'm very sympathetic to that. The other thing I have to ask, so in this situation, we are just talking about unwed mothers whose information is private, right, who the birth records are private, correct?
Mr. Carter-Ramos.
Madam Chair and Representative, mothers who are not married, correct?
Okay. So I guess I feel like the issue is getting a little conflated when we're talking about privacy rights of different individuals. To me, this is a very archaic language and archaic statute that is sort of demonizing mothers who are unwed and those children that come from that situation, which I don't think is fair, and I don't think most people would recognize it as such. I myself have a number of friends who are unwed and had children, and I don't think those children think of themselves as, you know, bastards or anything like that. They're just loved, wonderful children and deserve to have that $50 in their bank account for college savings later. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much for clarifying. I'm definitely in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. Next on the list is Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Pinto, I do have serious problems with this bill. Going through that, you're talking about the unwed mothers. But there's more and a lot more to that. This is, to me, what I'm reading, it's opening up sealed adoption birth records. As an adoptee, I have a lot of serious issues with that. Those were our confidential records set up with the mother ahead of time. They're sealed for a reason. The city of St. Paul has no right to those records. If the adopted person wants to get that when they get the adopted and amended birth certificate, that is fine. That's a public record. But the sealed adoption records should never be touched. Thank you.
Response, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I might, if I can, I believe there's a staff member from the Department of Health who's on, who's going to be available for any technical assistance. And I think that person, Ms. Crawford, may be able to comment about kind of how things work in terms of adoption issues.
All right. Ms. Crawford, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead.
Hi, I'm Molly Crawford. I'm the State Registrar with the Office of Vital Records at the Minnesota Department of Health. This bill does adoptee or adoption records in any way. Your conversation, it is true. In Minnesota, births to unmarried mothers default to a confidential birth record, meaning the civil registration and demographic information on that child's birth record would be considered confidential. That unmarried mother has the option at the time of birth when the record is being registered to choose to make the record public. If she doesn't make a choice, it defaults to confidential. Married mothers, their children's birth records are automatically public. The health information on all birth records is private information, and this bill does not address or need health information. The adoptee records are separate and they are addressed in a different part of the law. This bill would not allow us to share those sealed adoption records. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Crawford, for clarifying that. Next up on the list is Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill forward. I actually had the fortunate ability to work on this college savings account plan when it was developed in the mayor's office. And, you know, to represent Scott's question about having hospitals be able to have forms to opt in, that actually they explored all of those other those options, and that the operations of the way hospitals work, that they cannot do that. And so there are barriers to doing that. But that aside, you know, I just want to be very clear that when the college savings account was looking to explore why married a child born to a married parent's record was public, but if for a single mother, it is not, that no one was able to explain why that was the case, except for that this is an antiquated law. It is not there to actually protect anybody's specific data for any reason, except for that back in the day, you know, when there was a lot of shame around being a single mother. And so we looked at other states, and that it was not consistent within other states that it was separated this way as well. And that we were, from what I can recall, was one of the few states that actually do make single mother birth data private. And so I just wanted to thank Representative Pinto for bringing light to this particular issue and ensuring that our children who are born to single moms have the exact same opportunity and the exact same chances to go to college as others, as children who are born to parents who are married. I did just want to ask Mr. Karcharamos, a really quick question around what is that when you do an opt-in rate, what is the rate of those parents actually opting in, even if they're given all of the information? I'm just curious to see the difference, you know, what that rate is. Were you all able to collect that data?
Mr. Karcharamos.
Madam Chair and Representative, we had about 400 mothers opt in their child and still had another 1,600 or so who did not. So I'm not sure the exact percentage there, but approximately, I don't know, 15%, 12-15% did opt in.
Thank you.
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Karcharamos, for that response. And I did just want to say that when we put these barriers in place for no reason, it makes it really challenging for children to get the support that they need. We already know there is an issue with the opportunity gap and the achievement gap and the ability to go to college, and that this is a tool that's really important. I just wanted to confirm that I did look, and we are one of the only states that do this, and two other states have some similar, but it's not the same as ours. And so we are literally the last state that does this, and that this is timely, and it's time for us to make this change. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this forward.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Herr. And I will note, I know a lot of legislators actually use birth data to send out congratulations letters to constituents, and that comes from that public data. But apparently it's only about the babies whose parents happen to be married. Next on the list is Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto. Nice to see you. I wanted to talk more about the issue of who gets this. So in the bill, it says the entity administering the child savings program. So if you could tell me who that is, and then there's no guardrails around what they can use it for. It just says for opening the account. So once they open the account, then they destroy the data, or it's not used for managing the account. Or if you could just explain more who's using it and what they can use it for. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins, for getting us back to the bill. Representative Pinto.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I will direct that to Mr. Karcharamos, if I can, as the person who's kind of working directly with the program.
Mr. Karcharamos.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have a sort of auto upload that comes from the Department of Health right now. So we never actually get the file. It automatically goes into a secured database, and from there, that is where the family gets a mailing to basically invite them to join the program. So the birth record information is only used for those outreach purposes.
Follow-up, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so I'm sorry, who actually is administering the program, and when do they destroy the data? After you send that outreach, or once you create the account, then is the data destroyed, or is it needed for ongoing administration of the program?
Mr. Karcharamos.
Madam Chair, Representative, so in our situation, it is a city staff member who's the program manager. She has access to the database, and we don't use the data, you know, for any other reason. In terms of data retention and, you know, that sort of thing, you know, it does remain in the database and, you know, follows sort of the data retention policies of the city.
All right. Moving on to Representative Scott, and then we'll move on to the vote. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so what I understood Ms. Crawford to say is that the mother has a choice to make the information about the birth of her child either confidential or public. She has that choice. If she chooses confidentiality, why would we want to go against her wishes? For $50 in a bank account? Why would we want to do that? And Representative Pinto, there's, as Representative Robbins asked you, there's no guardrails around this data. There's no audit trail created. There's people that have a person that has access to that. There's no requirement in this bill that the data be deleted after the bank account is open. I don't understand why we'd want to take this choice away from a mom when she makes the decision upon the birth of her child. Maybe that child was conceived as rape. We don't know the circumstances, but the mom has made that choice. She's given a choice. She makes the decision. It's not our decision to come along and turn that on its head for a $50 bank account. I can't believe what I'm hearing here. I'm a no on this bill.
All right, Representative Herr, real quick, and then we are going to move on to the vote. It's been a long day for everybody.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask Representative Pinto testifier or person to answer the question of how many single mothers who have babies know that they can make that option, that choice to do that under birth certificate.
Mr. Karcher Ramos.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representative, most folks don't actually know that it is an option. The default option in the situation is that it's confidential and they're unaware, you know, that they're choosing confidential or not confidential.
All right. Last time, Representative Scott, we usually only let people talk once, but
I understand.
I will one more time, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does this testifier know that? How do they know that? Are they there? I don't know how he would possibly know the answer to that question that Representative Herr just asked.
All right. Closing words, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I should have noted that that I in fact worked on the with the advisory group Representative Herr referenced a number of years ago. This is something that's really been worked on for us for several years in figuring this out, because as has been alluded to, we have really an antiquated setup right now where some births are fully public and then other births we have this other situation. At some point we probably should be looking more broadly at that issue, but in the meantime, we know that there's this opportunity where it's the very children who are least likely to be, or most likely to have their moms be in a situation that I referenced by that testifier and our other committee, in the most challenging situations. We want to make sure that they're going to be able to have this access. Members, I really would encourage your support for this and making sure that we can get babies and kids off to a great start. Thanks so much.
Right. Thank you, Representative Pinto. With that, I renew my motion that House File 1942 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairbreaker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist. Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling. Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
Ivani, no.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Perfect. And Representative Feist? Representative Liebling? Perfect. There are 8 ayes and 6 nays.
The motion prevails, and House File 1492 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Pinto, and thank you to the testifiers. With that, I'm going to pass the gavel over one last time today to Vice Chair Mueller, since the last bill on the agenda is mine. So, Vice Chair Mueller, the gavel is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little tired right now. I haven't had as much coffee, now as I had this morning. So, members, the next bill is House File 1869. Chair Becker Finn, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I will move that House File 1869 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Members, this bill is, if you're familiar with the Safe at Home program through the Office of the Secretary of State, these are some updates to the Safe at Home program. And with that, I will pass it on to my testifier, Sam Bonowitz from the Office of the Secretary of State.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Sam Bonowitz. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Chair, members, my name is Sam Bonowitz, and I am the Director of Government Relations for the Office of the Secretary of State. Safe at Home is our state's address confidentiality program for people with very high safety needs, people who fear for their safety, like victims of domestic violence and stalking, but also members of our law enforcement. When people enroll, our office assigns them a St. Paul PO Box address that all public and private entities must accept and use as the person's real address. It goes on their driver's license, and anywhere that you or I would provide our address, Safe at Home participants provide their Safe at Home address. Safe at Home assists participants by forwarding their mail to them, helping them with interactions with third parties who need to understand legal compliance, problems with third party stakeholders, and by helping participants understand how to use the Safe at Home address to stay safe. The idea being that for the vast majority of participants, only the Safe at Home office knows the participant's true address, because most Safe at Home participants are crime and abuse victims. The use of this address allows them the ability to go about their daily life without having their true address accessible to the person that they fear. There are very, very rare occasions when another government office may need to know a participant's address, such as when a participant purchases a home or when there's a requested social service that must be delivered in the participant's home. And there are instances where a utility company needs to know a service address. The changes before you today will just improve upon the program's effectiveness for those who fear for their safety. This is largely the same as the bill that was heard in the Judiciary Committee last year. It is primarily technical in clarifying. It clarifies existing laws and definitions, such as the definition of mail for safe at home purposes. It requires participants submit a date of birth on their general notice so that government entities know which Sally Smith that they need to protect. It also allows participants who submit a notice to government entity the ability to decide for themselves what information of theirs needs to be protected. Each participant has a different circumstance and situations are very specific. And this change allows participants to control who knows what and who shares what information. And every person has their own uniquely tailored safety plan. This particular change has really been driven by local government entities with employees that need this flexibility to decide for themselves what is and is not private. Just as an example, employees with public-facing jobs like county attorneys or probation officers may want their home addresses protected, but would not be able to fulfill their job duties if the fact that they're an employee of that government entity is protected. It also clarifies that real property notices is not just a notice to the county recorder, but also applies to all property records held by a government entity, such as tax and assessment records. I am here for any questions, and I believe there are 2 people from Hennepin County that are also available for questions if you should have any.
Thank you. And I don't know that Chair Becker Finn, you had other testifiers, but I believe Mr. Neumeister wanted to testify in this bill as well. So welcome again, Mr. Neumeister. Please introduce yourself one more time and go ahead. You are muted right now. All right, well, we're trying to figure that out. Why don't we go to member questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the, Ms. Bonowitz? I can't see the last part of your last name on the screen there. excuse me. After all these years, I'm wondering why now do you need the date of birth?
Ms. Bonowitz.
Chair, members, that's a great question. And it's really because the program is expanding. We're getting more people that have similar or same names, and government entities need to be able to decipher which one they need to protect. And this was also driven largely by the local governments. And I think this might have been something that was driven in large part by Hennepin County. So someone from Hennepin County might be able to speak to this too.
Representative Scott, did you have any follow-up to that?
No, I didn't. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Neumeister, are you able to try again here with your testimony?
Is this in regards to the Secretary of State's bill?
Yes, it is.
Okay, I'm sorry. The question I had was on the publications. Many people use...
Hey, wait, Mr. Neumeister, can you just introduce yourself one more time here for the record?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. In the first part of the Secretary of State's bill for public information, distributes public data, it has some questions about where they're narrowing or questioning about the use of the directories. Those are great pieces of information that many people in the public use. One of the things I've seen a trend for is less printing and telling people to go online, but the printed book is still important. And in any of these efforts, I just want to make sure that this language does not say that there will not be public, you know, printed directories available at the request of a citizen at the Secretary of State's office. I hope that they just print enough so people can get that paper copy if they want that one. I still use it. I know many other people still use the paper copy for themselves.
Okay, thank you. Chair Becker Finn, did you have any comments to that, or did you want to call on one of your testifiers?
If one of the testifiers wants to take that, I'm not even sure which provision Mr. Neumeister was referring to. It may be referring to the underlying language as amended. It was amended last night in state government, and so now it's been narrowed just to the provisions regarding the Safe at Home program.
And it looks like Chair Becker Finn that Ms. Bonowitz is nodding her head, so go right ahead.
Chair members, I was going to say the exact same thing. That's from the introduced version, but that was amended out in committee yesterday.
All right, very well. I don't see any other member hands up. So at this point, Chair Becker Finn renews her motion that House File 1869 be recommended to be placed on the general register, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist. Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling. Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen. Representative Mortensen. Representative Novotny.
Novotny votes aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Fang.
Aye.
And Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Feist. Representative Liebling. Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
There are 14 ayes and no nays.
There being 14 ayes, the motion prevails, and House File 1869 is recommended to be placed on the general register. and members. We have finished our committee work for today. Our next hearing will be at our regularly scheduled time next Tuesday, and the agenda will be posted on the committee webpage. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.